Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Thank you so much for giving us the most precious thing you have, your time, so we continue to do what we always try to do, turn down the noise of the news cycle, get to the information that actually matters to understand the times we live in. I want to start right there with how we always open this program, talking about discerning the times we live in, turning down the noise. I'm guilty of it as anybody else is. The more you watch the news, the more you read the news, the more you intake news, if you have news items on your phone, if you have things happen, had it happen this morning, somebody sent me a link, said, hey, did you see this big blaring news headline, and, you know, talked about it for a minute. The more you consume news, the more you get into the news bubble. It's just human nature. You only have so much bandwidth. It's not a bad thing. It's not it's an accusation. I'm guilty of it. And probably if you're listening to podcasts like this one, you're probably guilty to it to some extent as well. So one of the things to turn the noise down is how bad are things? Because the more and more news you consume, because bad news sells better than good news, all things are terrible. Oh, everything's going to hell in a handbasket. Oh, we're up the creek without a paddle. Country's just falling apart. All the kids are running riot and going to jail and using drugs and just sticking on that TikTok, and that TikTok is poisoning their brains and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Certain things happen with age. My dad used to tell me there's no substitute for experience. Maybe this is an experience thing, but, you know, I remember the satanic panic in Dungeons & Dragons, and MTV was going to make us all drug addicts, and Dungeons & Dragons was going to make everybody Satanists, and if you rented the wrong kind of movies, we were all going to go to hell, and the country was going to fall apart, and blah, 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 blah. And that was in the 80s and early 90s. That was before we got the internet. So every generation, we kind of do this stuff, but with news media and social media and the symbiosis between those two things, it's gotten really bad the last few years. Can we just take a step back for a second? I'm not saying there isn't massive problems. There are. I'm not saying there's a lot of pain and suffering in the world. There is. I'm not even saying the country's in outstanding, perfect shape. It's not. We got a debt crisis. We got a political confidence crisis. We got an accountability crisis in government. We still have a disengaged citizenry where even in 2020 presidential election, one of the highest turnouts in a long time, we still only got 66% turnout. That's just not good enough. For a representative democracy to work, we should have much more involvement in that. So that still says a lot of people are turned off by the process. We got lots of problems. We've got poverty. We have almost every school district in the country. We have children in their reading and math scores for fourth graders and eighth graders are just not good enough. If you can't read, you can't learn, because reading is how you teach yourself how to learn, even beyond what the school system does. These are things we should be really worried about. Don't talk about them much. We have healthcare problems, not just the healthcare system. We just had it happen again. Healthcare system, had to take a kid to the ER a couple weeks ago, started sending me bills for it, paid the bill. They immediately turned around and said we didn't pay the bill, had to go round and round with them. You know, medical debt's an issue with folks. Medical billing's an issue with folks. Insurance is a thing with folks. We got problems with that. But how bad are things really? Even let's take something really bad. January 6th was horrible. I hated it. I'm on the record with it. You can read what I've wrote and said about it in the past. Not going to rehash it all here. You know, it wasn't the beginning and end of all human history, but it was a really bad day. It was a horrible day for the country. It was bad. It was ugly. It's some of the worst optics we've seen in a long, long time, especially in the social media age. And Congress was back in session a few hours after it was over. Oh, I know we've had over 1,000 people in court cases now, either charged or convicted or acquitted or so on and so forth. Over 1,000 court cases over the way people behave that day. And of course, the political fallout with a president who was President Trump at the time, now candidate Trump trying to run again. I know there's a lot of after effects at it. There's many applications, but the interpretation of the event was Congress was back in session that very night. By the way, it's very telling for you to go back and listen to what some of those people said that very night and how they've acted since. Looking at you, Lindsey Graham, Senator, South Carolina, go look at how he behaved that night and how he's behaved since. But as bad as January 6th was, and it was terrible, and it was horrible, Congress reconvened a few hours later. The system held up. Everybody's lost their mind over the Donald Trump verdict. He's guilty. Look, he's got an appeals process coming. There's a lot of legal people that think he'll have a good grounds for appeal on at least some of these charges because of the way the underlying charges were brought and presented. He's entitled to an appeal, so don't go doing any hot takes about banana republics and the fall of the system and it's a rigged thing. Don't get caught up on all that, because what happens if he wins on appeal and gets thrown out? Make sure you got stuff you can walk back. And by the way, anybody that went into your social media feeds and your news feeds and was talking about banana republics and all this, and just go ahead and block and mute them. They're not giving anything to your life right now. No, it wasn't a witch hunt. No, it wasn't unfair, whatever unfair means. Look, fair is what you pay the bus driver. Fair is where you go to ride the rides when you're a kid and it comes to the county. This doesn't have anything to do with fair. It was a court of law. There was a jury. They found him guilty. He'll have an appeal. We'll see what happens. He has other court cases. But stopping back up for a second, the president of the United States was convicted of a crime by a jury of his peers. Our own presidents were not above the law there. Whatever you think of the verdict, just think of the historic nature of that. Now we have the Hunter Biden guilty verdict. Now, this is another case, kind of like the Trumps. There's no doubt he did something wrong here, but was it criminal? That's what the jury was deciding in this case. And by the way, Hunter Biden has other criminal cases involving tax charges coming. This is just the gun case. He lied on the federal form. The jury found this. This is, in my opinion, this is what the jury has found. He was convicted on 3 counts of lying on his federal firearms application to get a weapon, which he purchased, and that he lied about his drug use and other things on it. Of course, part of his problem is his drug addiction is well documented. Now, if you want to talk about addiction, I'm happy to do that. We don't have enough conversations about addiction. But the fact is, the son of the sitting president of the United States of America, after 5 years of investigation, this investigation goes back to before Biden took office, by the way, the son of the sitting president of the United States was convicted in court. Now, just stop and think about that. That doesn't happen a lot in other countries. If you really had a banana republic, that sort of thing would never happen. Previous presidents would never have charges brought against them. The system's still holding up. Now, it's creaky. It's got problems. It's got issues. Yes, there's a two-tiered justice system. Hunter Biden has gotten a lot of slack over his entire life. Donald Trump has gotten a lot of slack over his entire life because they are either themselves or the children of powerful people. That's just the way it works. That's not right, but that's how it is. So don't say that it's completely unfair, because these are two individuals that have skirted the system for a very long time. But before we go to doom and gloom, just stop and think for a second. The son of the sitting president of the United States was convicted. A former president was brought to trial and convicted. January 6th, Congress was back in session that evening. We really ought to be more careful with the doom and the gloom and the bad stuff. Because is it as bad as we think? Is it going to be that bad in a year from now, 5 years from now, 20 years from now? Time sin gives you a chance to kind of change your opinion on things. New information gives you a chance to change your opinion on things. So maybe we shouldn't just go to the doom and gloom and all is lost rhetoric and clickage and memes and nonsense every time something happens in the news cycle that's really big and loud. Because in a year or two, something that big might actually happen. Kind of like the boy that cried wolf. If you're always doing doom and gloom, nobody's really going to want your doom and gloom opinion when the doom and gloom actually shows up. The system's still holding. Let's work on the cracks in the system and the problems in the system and quit acting like the system's the worst thing in the world. Because guess what, folks? The system's made up of people. We get the government and the judicial system and the legislative branch and all the rest of it that we deserve in a representative democracy. Decide what kind you want and start working towards that. And let's ease up on the doom and gloom and all is lost. Because it ain't, as long as we can still sit around and talk about it and complain about it. Let's just do a little bit better with it. More Herd Tower after this.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, welcome back to Herd Tower. I can't believe we have to keep talking about this Caitlin Clark thing, but here we are. This is amazing to me. Caitlin Clark got left off the Team USA. What's really happening here? We talked about this before. What's really happening with the Caitlin Clark thing is you have this marriage that was already ongoing between social and culture and political media that does the culture war stuff and political war stuff, and that's kind of all intertwined. And it creeps into the sports world because that's a different audience and it's a specific demographic and it's a specific way. And sports is kind of a universal thing to a lot of people the way politics isn't. So folks on both sides try to cross over in those mediums for viewership purposes, business purposes, things like that. This Caitlin Clark thing has just crossed all those streams and blown people away. My household last night was making fun of me like, why are you watching this basketball again? I just clicked on the last little bit of the Fever and Connecticut Sun game just to see what was going on. Fever was getting blown out again because Connecticut's one of the best teams. Fever's one of the worst teams. This is the third time they've played this year. They've all been blowouts. But I was just curious because it's interesting. It's amazing to watch. There's a couple strands of this needs to be talked about. Now, first of all, this Team USA thing, it's a defendable basketball decision. Caitlin Clark did not go to the last pretrial workout camp because she was in the Final Four. So there was other people already involved in that process. You can legitimately have a conversation that she's not in the best 12. You got to build a basketball team. So they're only going to take three or four guards probably for the entire team. Is she the best three or four guards in the league? No, not right now today. Maybe someday she will be, but she's not right now. The basketball decision here was infinitely defendable. It was probably the correct decision basketball wise. Because there's better players, more experienced players. The international game is very different from the NBA, which Caitlin Clark is just learning, which is very different from the college game. And Team USA, remember, we've been dominant for many, many years. They really want to make sure they win. And people be like, well, it doesn't matter, 12th person on the bench. You have no idea who that 12th person on that bench was. Don't act like you did. Stop. The basketball decision is defensible for leaving her off. The business decision is really bad because the Olympics is a big-time viewing platform. It's a lot of money. NBC pays a lot of money for that. It's a lot of eyeballs. Business-wise, to grow the game, you probably would want to put her on there to increase the attention. Now, here's where the streams start getting crossed, though. Why that happened isn't being discussed as a basketball decision versus a business decision. It's being discussed as, however, people have already put their stamps culture war-wise on the Caitlin Clark situation. So they start putting it on, oh, she's being picked on, or she's being targeted, or she's being singled out. Yeah, new stars in sports leagues get targeted. They get singled out. Go watch some tape of 89, 90, 88 Michael Jordan playing the Pistons and see what they were tackling him. They were beating him up. Rising stars, established stars. Established stars are going to beat you down. They're going to test you. They're going to push you. By the way, you know who knows this better than anybody? Caitlin Clark. She said it. She's fine with it. She understands it. I'm a star coming in. A lot of hype. I've got to be ready for it. I'm going to be tested. I'm going to be pushed. So people have started putting things like gender issues, race issues, all these things on there. And what you really need to do with that is not just see what they're putting on there. You need to see what they're telling you about themselves. If they're not comfortable with gender issues, it's going to show in how they're talking about the Caitlin Clark situation. If they're not comfortable with racial issues, that's going to come out really quick because people with prejudices just seem to have this need to demand that they show you what their prejudices are when something like this happens. There's all those issues there. There's also the issues of the existing WNBA players. I completely understand where they're coming from. Think about it this way. They've been in that league. They've been working. Now things are changing. They just now got charter travel. They're talking about their pay going up. They're probably going to get more endorsement deals. Things are changing for the better, but there's also a little bit of, hey, we've been here all along doing this, working hard, playing hard, doing all this. We've built this league. Where's our credit? That's understandable. You can't really blame them for that. And yes, some of that gets targeted towards Caitlin Clark. Here's the one I find really interesting, though. How many people seem to have a real problem getting their heads around grown women in a competitive sport acting competitively, acting physically? One thing about watching these WNBA games, and I've watched most of Caitlin Clark's games and a couple of the other ones. My family's making fun of me for it. I've been watching them so much. It's a physical league. It's physical basketball. It's athletic. It's up and down. It's not the league that it was when it first started out. It's not women's basketball of 20, 25 years ago. It's much more athletic. It's very physical, very competitive. People get hot. People get angry. Guess what? If you've watched any NBA or men's college basketball or anything down at the rec league in your neighborhood or even a pickup game, basketball is a competitive sport. You're hot, sweaty, bumping on people, grinding, especially if you're in any kind of a very competitive league. Basketball is physical. It's always been physical. It's, even in the new age where we shoot a lot of threes, it's still physical. And the women play very physical style basketball. And it's very apparent that people are very uncomfortable about this. They don't like hard fouls. They don't like attitude. They don't like an enforcer sending a message. Look, when I played basketball in high school a million years ago, it was still old school. Like, you didn't give anybody a free layup. Somebody had a layup and they were there. You tried to take them down. It was old school back then still. And I'm not that old. I'm only 44. I hear John Gattuso over here. Like, don't you give anybody a free layup. You hit them. Make sure they know. Make sure they miss the shot if you foul them, but foul them. Don't give them free anything. The women's game has evolved to where it's physical and competitive. And it seems to really bother people. They can't get their head around that. And that doesn't tell me anything about the NBA other than the quality of competition is going up because, especially in America, for 20, 25, 30 years now, we have, as a society and culture, spent a lot of time, money, and energy encouraging women's athletics on all levels. And now we're reaping the fruit of that with some really amazing athletes. But those athletes are competitive and physical. And yet some people still don't seem to be okay with them being physical and competitive. That's where you just need to get over it. They're grown women. Let them push and shove a little bit. Let them fight if they want to fight. Let them be competitive. That's what makes the game good. And if you actually care about women's basketball, women's sports in general, and the WNBA in particular, and you want the sport to grow, the more competitive it is, that's the better viewing product. Because the one thing these people are right about, some of the business argument of this is a business. And the business product that's being presented on TV, the more competitive it is, the more fire, the more emotion, the better stories that makes, the better TV that makes, the better ratings you get, the more money for the players and the people involved in the league. It's that simple. The NBA and the NFL do a great job of selling stories and making it a good TV product. The WNBA needs to embrace that as well. They need to do things to emphasize the personalities and the stories and the competitiveness. And everybody else is going to have to get used to that. And people that can't handle competitive women's sports, probably time to just start tuning them out. More Hertel right after this. Welcome back to Hertel. I just read a piece by Amelia Nicely, who's a wonderful reporter in the state of West Virginia for West Virginia Watch. She's as good a reporter as you'll find anywhere. If you don't follow her Amelia Nicely on the Twitter. West Virginia Watch is an outstanding outlet. She was writing about education outcomes as child poverty increases in the data in the state of West Virginia. If you're not familiar by now, I'm West Virginian. I just can't help but focus on my home state and what's going on. But I want to use this to explain something about how I view the world, because every so often somebody gets after me about this or that or the other politically. I am pretty uninterested in partisan politics these days. I like watching it, but I watch partisan politics the way you'd watch pro wrestling. I know most of it's a fake show because the good guy and the bad guy are really working together to make money. That's how partisan politics works nowadays. The uniparty stuff's nonsense. Anybody that talks about uniparty, they're not a functional adult ready to discuss politics in America in the year of our Lord 2024. But partisan politics is really intramurals or JV. I want to deal with the varsity stuff, the stuff that matters, the stuff that really is important, and that's power structures, money, power, the usual stuff. Because thing about partisan politics is once they're in power, they all become corrupt and don't have corrupting influences unless we hold them accountable and keep them on terror. So I don't really care about your partisan politics. If you make a partisan argument, you've already lost me, because I don't care who your person is. Even if I vote for them, my job once they're in office is to hold them accountable, not hold their hand and help them do whatever they want to do. But one of the reasons I get to that conclusion is because of my home state of West Virginia. West Virginia has been in the bottom of every measurable in poverty, education, healthcare, whatever you want to pick. They've been at the bottom for my entire life. So if partisan politics was going to fix things like education, healthcare, poverty, whatever, pick something, economic opportunity. The state of West Virginia when I was a kid was completely controlled by the Democratic Party. I'm talking to just a handful of people in the legislature. Every now and then you'd get a Republican governor, maybe a Republican member of the House of Delegates every now and then in certain places. But all through the 80s, 90s, up until about 2000s, the early 2000s, it was as blue a state as there was in the Union. Over the last 25 years, it has gone to become one of the most red states in the Union. Donald Trump won it by the biggest margin of any state in 2016, 42 points. Deep, deep red state now politically. That much of a swing in that small of a time frame. And yet, you're still at the bottom in education, still at the bottom in health outcomes, still got poverty issues, has a huge opioid crisis. I've got more writing coming out very soon, and I'm never going to let go of what's going on in the child welfare system in West Virginia. It's appalling. It should be the top of the news item on every item. 7,000 foster kids, and they don't know what to do with them. We have dead children because of the CPS falling through the cracks. Now, I could get on a real long rant about those problems. And I have, I'm blessed where I have platforms where I can write about them. I have pending writing out about the Kennedy Miller case right now, ready to go to publish. I have a couple different outlets. If I go to them and say, hey, I've got this piece about this, would you let me run it? They would run it. So I've got a position to do that, but that also brings a responsibility. If I pretended like partisan politics was going to save Kennedy Miller's life or was going to fix the atrocious reading and math scores that fourth graders and eighth graders have in a state that my parents spent their entire careers being educators in, that I was educated in, that one of my children was educated in, that one of my children goes to college in now. If I tried to just make all that about partisan politics, that's not truthful, because I have lived experience and I have the data that tells me that the same state with the same problems went from complete control by one political party to complete control of the other political party, and nothing meaningful changed outside of the nomenclature that we see on the advertisements when it comes election time. Oh, they'll point to some things they've done. They've done some things like school choice. I'm not against school choice. I think school choice is a good thing. There's individual policies you can pick out. There's been good Democratic governors. There's been good Republican governors. There's good Democratic House of Delegates and state senators and bad ones. What I'm saying for the big picture, though, is we get so caught up on the team jerseys and the politics of the partisanship when we have the data in a state right now in front of us within our lifetimes, the limits of what partisanship actually does. Because it's not partisanship and the party affiliations that actually change things. It's people holding their government accountable, state, local, federal, all of it, to do what they're supposed to do to get the people what they need from their government for the tax dollars that they take from them to provide those things. Now, that's a very simple concept that we have completely lost sight of, because we're too busy fighting culture wars and winning team jersey wars between team red and team blue, or we get too head up about a certain politician and we think they're going to be the thing that saves all things, and therefore they can't have anything wrong with them, and I can't admit any failure to that person because then something's wrong with me, or admit the other side might have a point, blah, 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 blah. I'm tired of it. I don't care if you're a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, or the Grand Watusi of the Woola Woola. Whatever you are, once you are in office, even if I vote for you, even if I support you, even if I donated to your campaign, my support of you stops the minute you take the oath of office for whatever office you got elected to. And my job goes from support to accountability, because that's my job as a citizen. And that's what everybody else should be doing too. They're not your person once they get in office. They're our person serving us, and they need to serve us and be held accountable to what they're supposed to be doing. And if we don't do that, this is bad for the radio audience, but this is me gesturing broadly to everything that's going on right now. Unaccountable government by an unaccountable people is an untenable situation. Partisanship isn't going to fix that. More Hertel right after this. Welcome back to Hertel. I wrote a piece about misinformation. Got some pushback. Let's talk about it. I hate the term misinformation these days. Everybody's using it, but everybody uses it to just mean whatever they want it to mean. Here's the core issue of what I was trying to get at, and what I think is, there's been some other people pointed this out as well. The problem with misinformation, the term, is that it has a very specific meaning, a very self-evident meaning. The problem with misinformation, the business model, the buzzword, the thing that folks have decided need to be a part of the nomenclature of the times we live in, is that it's a self-defeating thing. I use the terminology, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I explained it this way. When you take something and label it as misinformation, yeah, you're calling it misinformation, but there's no way for you to run a news story on misinformation without explaining the misinformation. I remember when I was doing a volunteer firefighter way back in the day before 9/11 happened, we had some free time on our hands and we were bored. They taught us a very important lesson where you'd go in the fire tire and there'd be a fire with a certain kind of material, usually mixed with some straw or something. And the lesson was, if you just go up and just hit it as hard as you can with a pressurized water hose, you don't put the fire out. You actually end up spreading it all around you because you hit it directly. And then they teach you about, you know, indirect heat and oxygen flow and things like this and how to put a fire out various different ways. That if you just walk up, hit it with a high pressure hose, all you did was blow up the fire. It blows all the way around. And because it's an enclosed room, it literally goes over your head behind you. And all of a sudden you're surrounded by fire and it's your own fault. I think about that when I think about these people talking about misinformation. And there's a couple different layers to this. There's the fact checkers. Remember those guys? They fact check things. And we write think pieces about things. I'm guilty of that too. I do it. I've even wrote a piece once called some, we call them, among writers and editors, we actually call them, you know, somebody said something on the internet pieces. Well, somebody said something, let's write a think piece about it, right? Misinformation, this is where we're at, because the news media, and I don't want to just pick on the news media needs symbiosis with social media to function right now. And one of the ways they do it is they pick out something either in social media or an alternate media or in a lower level media from they are, and they'll pick it and they'll go, this isn't misinformation. They explain it. But like we were talking about with that fire bail, there's no way for them to cover it on their elevated platform without spreading it themselves. And it becomes this self-defeating thing, self-fulfilling prophecy. They're telling you the misinformation to more and more people just to explain it's misinformation. They're writing think pieces and fact checks on stuff that 15, 20, 30 years ago, the news would not have even bothered worrying about. See, some things need to just be pointed and laughed at and ignored or mocked relentlessly. And the news media isn't built for mocking and pointing and laughing. That's what satire is for. That's what comedy's for. Although we have comedy and satire news shows now. You know, news media is not equipped for that. So when they seriously cover something that's ridiculous, the ridiculous thing automatically gets a note and an air of seriousness to it, even if they're denouncing it. There's this thing in media. Media is in what's called the signals business. There's meaningful signals and unmeaningful signals. The way they signal whether something's meaningful or not is really easy on TV media especially, but you can do this in radio and podcasting and other formats. Top of the story. Top of the program, big graphics. You may have a special graphic just for the event that tells you this is important. It's a meaningful signal. They're not saying this is important. They're playing dramatic music. They have a screen graphic. Wolf Blitzer's standing there going breaking news in the way he always does. I love Wolf. I'm not picking on him, but he'll do it with the break. And they'll even make a special little graphic for it. That's a signal. It's a meaningful signal. Hey, this is important. Pay attention to this. That's the business the news media is in. Where in the newscast they put your item tells you how important it is. By and large, a newscast goes from most important to not least important, but lesser important than the most important thing. The most important thing also gets front-loaded on what's going to get the most attention because it's a business model. This is the meaningful signals business. The problem is when the meaningful signals is about misinformation, you're kind of crossing your streams on what's important and what's not. And the meaningful signal, all of a sudden, is about something people immediately recognize as soon as you see it as something that is meaningless. In other words, you wind up on the wrong end of the boy who cried wolf moral. You know, the wolf's coming and the villagers come out with pitchforks ready to fight. And they're like, I didn't say it. And he's the wolf's coming and he comes out and then it's like, problem was eventually he said the wolf's coming and the wolf really was coming and nobody believed him anymore. News media and social media and alternate media want to be gatekeepers of information. But when they focus so much on misinformation, they're undercutting their own gatekeeping. because gatekeeping bad information that as soon as you go, this is misinformation, and you spend time absorbing it, and people look at it and go, well, that's silly and stupid. I didn't need that explained. It's like talking to my teenagers, where my teenagers just like, I didn't need you to explain that to me. I knew that already. But as a parent, I'm trying to explain it to them. That's how some of this starts coming off. Misinformation has lost all meaning. And our news media and our social media would be a lot better if people would recognize that, stop using the term as a pejorative and as an explainer item in and of itself, and just go back to covering things as it needs to be covered. Now, that's probably more pie in the sky, because misinformation trends well and it brings clicks and stuff. But what it's really doing is really, really harming the folks that we need to be able to rely on for accurate information. Or the way I put it in the piece, I'll link to it when I go off. It was on the Sunday newsletter. If you subscribe at hertel.substack.com, the way I put it is, one person's misinformation is always going to be another's monetized keyword. Best we can do, try to know the difference. More Hertel right after this. Welcome back to Hurt Tell. Let's end on a good note. This was kind of heavy stuff today. We've been talking about West Virginia. Let's stick with West Virginia because it's my show. I can do what I want. We're going to talk about West Virginia. But this is a really big deal, folks. West Virginia, of course, you know, I'm a foodie. I love food. Twitter Supper Club, the hashtag, if you want to join us. I love food. Chef Paul Smith has been a fixture in Charleston, West Virginia. That's the state capital, for those of you that don't know, or if you're from Logan. And he's been a fixture for a long time. He's beloved for a lot of reasons. He was nominated for a James Beard. If you don't know what a James Beard is, it's hard to explain it. You may have heard it if you watch a lot of Food Network shows, chefs get introducing. It's a big deal. It's kind of like an Oscar. I don't even know how to explain it. People call it the Oscar of the food world, but it's a lot more to it than just that. It's a big, big, big deal. And Chef Paul Smith was up for it. They had a big watch party at Capital Market, and he won Best Chef Southeast. That's a huge deal. And it's really important. Metro News, two words that I've never mentioned here before. West Virginia Chef Paul said as he accepted the prestigious award on Monday night. That would be Monday, the 10th of June, whenever you're listening to this. And there was an uproar from the hundreds of area residents as it was announced that Smith had won. They had gathered for a watch party at Capital Market in downtown Charleston to show their support. Capital Market Executive Director Evan Osborne said Chef Paul is a staple of the local culinary arts community and was only right for him to be taking home an award. Quote, he has done so much to lift our local food scene, from working with local producers to celebrating other restaurants and local chefs. So it's heartwarming to see anyone come together in this way. Along with being the owner of the three local restaurants, 1010 Bridge, Ellen's Ice Cream, and The Pitch, that's a sports bar, Chef Paul Smith is also Capital Market's culinary ambassador, which means he's the face of everything the market does. He's also part of one old product brand called Blue Smoke Salsa that actually knew the people that originally started it in Anstead years and years ago. They brought it back. They've redone the model. He's on the board for that. If you see Blue Smoke Salsa, go look that up. Back to the piece. As a free plug, didn't cost you anything. We're available, though. We take PayPal. Osborne said Smith's job doesn't end at his restaurant's closing time, quote, because I know that he's leaving to be down here to help do a lot of our local cooking classes with AARP. Or to serve on, I don't know how many boards of directors. He really lives and breathes, not just Charleston, but all of West Virginia. Smith went up against culinary art aficionados from five other states, Georgia, Kentucky, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee. Folks, I've spent a lot of time in Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina. I got a home in North Carolina. The food down there is good. If you beat all them folks out, you're doing something. The James Beard Awards are considered to be the Academy Awards for Chef. Its categories are comprised of regions all across the country. Smith specifically accepted the award for 1010 Bridge, his flagship restaurant, as well as the particular restaurant that had been nominated. He was grateful for everybody. And I'll just add this in. He actually said ahead of time that the big deal for him was he wanted credit for the restaurant and the people that worked for him and everybody that supported him. This is a big, big deal for West Virginia. And I know he's a Charleston staple, but West Virginians, we're a little insular on things. When we get something like this, and he's one of our own, this is a huge deal to get a James Beard, to recognize not just the cuisine, but the culture of food that he has built up, as Charleston has really revitalized itself in some ways. Still a city that's got a lot of work to do in certain areas, but things like Capital Market and the food scene's really coming on, and Chef Paul's a big part of that. And we want to make sure we take a minute to highlight that. If you go to Charleston, West Virginia, great little city, by the way, good place to visit, right down the road from the New River Gorge, not too far from up yonder. Come holler at our folks. But if you've never been through Charleston, good time to go visit, especially Friday nights on the levee. They do the live music right on the waterfront of the river. It's pretty cool. That'll do it for Hurtel, however you're listening, however you're watching on YouTube or anywhere else. I don't know if anybody bootlegs this, but if it's a bootleg, let us know so we can get them the links to the actual stuff. iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, any podcasting platform there are, including ones in India, Germany. There's one from Eastern Europe. I wasn't sure how to pronounce it, but I went ahead and put it in anyway, so we're on that one. You put in Hurtel Show, you put in my name, you're going to get us. We appreciate you. Hurtelshow@gmail.com if you want to reach out to us. Hurtel Show on the Twitter if you want to find us on the Twitter machine, X, whatever Elon's calling it this week. Also, Hurtel.substack.com, one-stop shopping for everything I do. If I do a media appearance, if I write anything anywhere that I can share back, it'll all be on there. You'll be able to find it. We've got some really big news coming up as far as my writing goes. I've got something that's going to be announced as I record this. I'm recording this Wednesday of this week. We're going to be able to announce something pretty exciting. Can't wait to share that with you folks. Something close to my heart, something I've been wanting to do. I think we can do some good work with it. But until then, wherever you and yours are, across the street or around the world, we hope you're well. We hope you are well fed, and we cannot wait to talk to you again for more Hurtel. Take care. All the music on Hurtel is provided under a Creative Content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.